From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week's view discusses a number of recent studies in vascular medicine and hypertension, all of which can be found on ACC.org. Sometimes I tell my colleagues that vascular medicine and hypertension are like the Rodney Dangerfield of cardiovascular medicine. We focus a lot on the heart, but there's so much action that's happening in the blood vessels, and they deserve their due. And this week's podcast takes care of that with some very interesting recent studies. The first study I'd like to discuss was published in a recent issue of the European Journal of Cardiology by Bangalore et al., and it sought to examine the association of blood pressure on admission and in-hospital outcomes for patients who present with an ischemic stroke. And as you're all aware, this is often an interesting and somewhat challenging area for us. The notion, of course, that a lower blood pressure would be associated with less likelihood of an ischemic stroke transitioning to hemorrhagic stroke. On the other hand, also the notion that a stroke is often associated with changes in regulation of blood flow in the brain, and having an adequate pulse pressure head in the brain is helpful for reducing the likelihood of more extension of the ischemic burden. So this is a study that was put together by authors looking at the Get With The Guidelines stroke registry. They looked at the admission systolic and diastolic blood pressure, as well as mean arterial pressure. They studied in-hospital mortality, whether a patient was discharged to home or to an extended care facility, the inability to ambulate independently at discharge, and then also hemorrhagic complications due to thrombolytic therapy. And they created odds ratios adjusted for reference values for different types of blood pressure presentation. It was a big study, over 300,000 patients with ischemic stroke. And there was a J-shaped curve and relationship between the admission systolic blood pressure and outcome. Lower and higher systolic pressures seem to correlate with higher risk. For example, in terms of in-hospital death, the odds ratio was 1.16, comparing a blood pressure systolic 120 to a systolic of 150. And similarly, the odds ratio comparing a blood pressure of 200 to 150 was 1.24. This is again for in-hospital death. Similarly, they found that for the variable not discharged to home, that is going to an extended care facility, there was a difference, odds ratio 1.11, comparing blood pressure of 120 to a blood pressure of 150, and 1.15, comparing 200 to 150. Interestingly, in terms of the risk of hemorrhagic complications of thrombolytic therapy, a lower blood pressure was better. So the odds ratio was 0.89, or 11% less, if the systolic pressure was 120 versus 150. And the odds ratio was 1.21 if the pressure was very high, say at 200 versus 150. So it's an interesting study. It demonstrates this J or U-shaped relationship between blood pressure and outcomes, including death in patients presenting with an acute ischemic stroke. Certainly, the data supports the notion that the sweet spot for blood pressure lies somewhere between 120 and 150, not as low as 120, not as high as 150, perhaps. And we really need more data in order to verify what is the best possible blood pressure of all. Studies like this from very large registries can be very helpful in helping us have a sense for the most likely spot, but we really need randomized trials to give us more information about exactly where we should focus. There's another article this week, which was actually a very nice review in the journal Heart, which reviewed current status of resistant hypertension. This review by Shepherd et al. Was just published, and I thought it was useful for our audience. Resistant hypertension generally is defined as uncontrolled clinic blood pressure greater than 140 over 90 after treatment with three or more antihypertensives. And in the UK, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, the guidelines specify that these three antihypertensives generally should include optimal doses of an ACE inhibitor or alternatively an ARB, a calcium channel blocker, and a diuretic, most typically a thiazide. Obviously, one of the biggest causes of what appears to be resistant hypertension is not. It's pseudo-resistant hypertension. And this can be caused by poor clinic blood pressure measurement technique, most often by patient non-adherence to prescribed medications, sometimes patient intolerance to certain medications, and as you and I know, sometimes they don't tell us what they're not taking, white coat hypertension, or a combination of these. In general, this particular review suggests that the treatment of resistant hypertension should be focused on, first, clarifying and validating that the patient is taking adequate doses of the previously mentioned three classes of antihypertensives, and then adding a fourth line drug. The causes of resistant hypertension, truly resistant hypertension, are somewhat poorly understood, but one hypothesis is that this is caused by an inappropriate sodium retention in the kidneys. And for this reason, the NICE guidelines recommend that spironolactone therapy would be an excellent fourth-line agent in patients, particularly who have a potassium less than 4.5 on the aforementioned drugs. For patients who have a potassium greater than 4.5, the authors recommend considering doubling the existing dose of the thiazide diuretic that the patients typically might be on. For a patient intolerant to spironolactone, if it was an issue such as gynecomastia, then one could substitute eplerenone, or if it was some other intolerance, including elevated potassium levels, then perhaps a drug like amiloride, a different diuretic, might be useful. Currently, the role for renal denervation, carotid baroreceptor stimulation, or central arteriovenous anastomosis, more aggressive strategies, are really ill-defined and unknown. I thought the article was well-written, and I thought these key points to remember were useful. Many of us deal with tough hypertension in our clinics every week, and focusing in back on the definition of resistant hypertension and our response to that, I thought was an excellent piece. And I certainly have found that spironolactone is an outstanding fourth agent in my practice in patients who appear to have resistant hypertension. So now we're going to move from the hypertension space to more the vascular space. And I want to bring to your attention an article that was published this week in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. It's a very interesting article that attempts to quantify the plaque burden of subclinical atherosclerosis in order to predict the risk beyond cardiovascular risk factors. And it's entitled Subclinical Burden of Carotid and Femoral Atherosclerosis in Midlife, the PESA study, P-E-S-A study. The PESA study is a group of patients, 3,860 patients enrolled in a progression of early subclinical atherosclerosis study. These generally are young patients, average age 46, about two-thirds are male. And the study is looking at the frequency of bilateral carotid and femoral territory plaque by 3D vascular ultrasound to look at the number of plaques and their territories, and in fact, a global plaque burden defined as the sum of all plaque volumes. And it's correlating these with other cardiovascular risk factors and the patient's known estimated 10-year cardiovascular risk. Overall, in these nearly 4,000 patients that were screened, they were a low-risk group. The median ASCVD 10-year risk score was about 2.17%. 80% of them were in the low-risk category of 3.4% in men and about 0.78% risk at 10 years in women. Interestingly, despite the low risk, the median global plaque burden was nearly 51 millimeter cubed, and it was more pronounced in men than women, 63 versus 25.3. There was an increasing burden of plaque with age and male gender, as I mentioned, smoking and dyslipidemia. In fact, age, male gender, smoking, and dyslipidemia were more strongly associated with femoral than carotid plaque burden, whereas hypertension and diabetes really didn't show a difference there. So it's a very interesting study showing a remarkable amount of plaque burden in this low-risk cohort, 45% of whom had absolutely no cardiovascular risk factors at all. Many of you have probably used the MESA risk score as a tool to estimate 10-year risk using traditional Framingham-like cardiovascular risk factors plus a coronary calcium score. This paper leads me to ask the question, will there be a PESA risk score, P-E-S-A, which potentially could also be used to get more granular risk estimation in patients who, based on traditional markers, appear to be in a lower risk cohort? Certainly, I think we want to try to get better at personalizing risk estimates. And this particular article I thought was interesting in looking at the use of three-dimensional ultrasound to look at plaque presence and burden in lower-risk patients. More to come, and certainly we need studies looking at intervention to decide if this type of imaging will find value in current-day practice. Another paper I'd like to mention this week is one that was published in Stroke. It's called Carotid Stenting versus Endarterectomy for Asymptomatic Carotid Artery Stenosis, a systematic review and a meta-analysis by Morisoli and colleagues. In this study, the investigators searched various databases to find the randomized controlled trials comparing carotid artery stenting versus carotid endarterectomy in asymptomatic patients using pre-specified protocols. And the authors settled on 11 reports from 5 randomized controlled trials, which basically randomized over 3,000 patients who were asymptomatic. And then they looked at the pooled incidence of periprocedural disabling stroke as well as periprocedural stroke or death. And interestingly, the authors concluded based on the trials to date that the relative risk of periprocedural stroke is 1.84 if you compare carotid artery stenting versus surgical endarterectomy. Similarly, the risk of disabling stroke, relative risk of 1.95, and any periprocedural stroke or death, relative risk of 1.72, all of these trending to show an increased risk after carotid artery stenting versus endarterectomy. I thought that it was a powerful paper. Clearly, we would benefit from a much larger randomized trial in the current era with current excellent evidence-based medical treatment on top of additional anatomic treatment for severe stenoses. But this is a paper that I thought was worth mentioning in this vascular medicine space. Clearly, we still do stenting for patients who particularly are extraordinarily high risk or, in fact, unapproachable with a surgical approach. But I do commit this paper to your reading because I think it's excellent. So let me finish by just mentioning to you that we've presented a case on ACC.org, which is also interesting. It's a 40-year-old female with a history of hypertension and pulsatile tinnitus who develops left-sided neck pain and drooping of her eyelid after chiropractic manipulation. I would suggest that you go to ACC.org, look at the case, look at the images, and vote on what you think it is. I did this today, and I voted with 60% of the rest of you who thought it was a certain diagnosis. But I do recommend our cases. I think they're excellent in terms of reinforcing teaching points relating to history, and in this case, some excellent images. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This week, I've tried to cover the Rodney Dangerfield of cardiovascular medicine, that is, vascular medicine and hypertension. Some nice papers that I think have important learning points for all of us for our weekly practice. And you can find this information online at acc.org, the papers, the journal scans, and the case that I mentioned. And until next week, I hope all is well, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Thank you.